Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Cinema Clash podcast. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com, and with me is my co-host, Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, Charlie.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. It's really chilly out there this evening.
It is freezing out there tonight where we are in Washington, D.C., but I have something to look forward to in my immediate future, because last week, folks, we left you off on a cliffhanger. Me and Hannah bet on which movie would make more money at the box office. Was it going to be The Choice, Hannah's decision, or was it going to be Hail Caesar, my pick? One of them made $11.4 million. One of them made $6.1 million. Hannah, who won?
I think we both lost, Charlie, because what really won was the panda movie, Kung Fu Panda 3. So I think we sort of both lost the bet, but I'm not one to welch on my bet, so I did indeed bring you a bottle of wine, as promised, just meeting the minimum $5 threshold.
I bet it was $4.99 plus tax.
That's exactly what it was.
Now, Kung Fu Panda 3 may have won again at the box office, and Hail Caesar came in second, but The Choice, you make it sound like it came in third. It didn't. It came in fifth, behind, like, the 19th week of Star Wars and The Revenant. It lost to all of those.
I still think it'll be interesting to see what happens further down the line when it's both have been out for a few more weeks and when the rentals hit the market. I think this will be a I think The Choice will be more popular in the rental category.
I say we never have another competition again involving The Choice, and we just move on to something else.
Okay, as long as we can still keep the wine competition going, in which case here I present you a bottle of wine.
I don't even... Folks, her bottle of wine is... It's like one of those mini bottles you get on the airplane.
It's a little bigger.
This is... What is this? What am I supposed to do with this?
And I think it's screw top, so it's even easier for us to open.
Thank you so much for my airplane bottle of wine.
It's a fine Merlot.
It's a Malbec.
Oh, it's a Malbec. Sorry. It's a fine Malbec.
Oh, well, this is what a treat.
Yes.
More importantly, Hannah, did you watch the Super Bowl?
I did. I did not watch it intently. I sort of multitasked while I was watching it so that I could watch the commercials and watch the halftime show and then catch a little bit of the game.
Well, during the commercials, we saw the new previews for huge summertime blockbusters. We're talking Captain America, Civil War, X-Men, Apocalypse. And I was thinking, how am I ever supposed to take these movies seriously after watching Deadpool? Because all Deadpool would do would be to make fun of Captain America. Deadpool is the widest release this weekend, and I think he has turned the superhero genre on its head.
It is probably going to be the most popular of the new releases, that's for sure. But I am not so sure that it's really for everybody. I think it's one of those movies that it's a bit odd. I enjoyed it. I absolutely enjoyed it. But I don't think people who aren't into the superhero genre to begin with will enjoy it because it truly mocks the very genre that it is a part of, and that's what makes it entertaining and funny. But if you aren't familiar to some degree with the other Marvel characters, with the X-Men, with the Avengers, then I don't think you're really going to get this movie. I laughed. I thought it was very entertaining. It was different. But it was not what I would consider mainstream entertainment.
Funny you should mention mainstream, as you still bill yourself as the mainstream chick, the mainstream critic.
I am the mainstream chick, which means I feel that it is my obligation to watch these movies with the mainstream crowd in mind. What are they going to like or not like? What works for the majority of people, what might make a movie that might not be traditionally mainstream still appeal to certain segments of the population. So I just try to make sure that people kind of get that sense of whether or not they will truly like a movie, regardless of what some of the highbrow critics have to say about it.
You know, even though it is so quirky and different, Deadpool is mainstream. This is going to tear the box office open this weekend. Everyone's going to see Deadpool. It is mainstream. And I knew we were onto something special when I saw the opening credits. It's not starring blah, blah, blah. It's not directed by blah, blah, blah. It's starring action hero and moody teenager and British villain and CGI animated character. And it's directed by a D-bag and written by the real heroes.
Yes.
Brilliant. I've never seen that done before.
It was a wonderful sequence, the opening credits, all set to the wonderful song Angel of the Morning, a Juice Newton classic.
This huge interstate overpass action behemoth, fireballs, semi-trucks turning over action scene is set to Angel of the Morning. It's fascinating. And later on, a key song during another key fight is Wham's Careless Whisper saxophone solo. How brilliant is this? And the whole thing is snappy. The dialogue is so quick. It's lightning fast. It's rapid fire, especially with the pop culture references. If you are not up on pop culture, folks, you're going to miss half the jokes flying around here.
Absolutely. I mean, the Hugh Jackman jokes, the People's Sexiest Man Alive covers appear in there a few times. And this one will probably put Ryan Reynolds back in that in the superhero marquee, because he really had a dud with the Green Lantern, and I think this one redeems him. And he had obviously had just a ton of fun with it. But again, this is not a superhero movie for kids, and I think it's really, really important that the parents out there understand that.
Absolutely. Children should not go see Deadpool, even though it's awesome. That's right. Someone counted, and there's 84 F-bombs. And someone gave it 10 out of 10 on the profanity scale. And it's really dirty. And there's a lot of sex in it. Straight up sex in Deadpool.
Absolutely.
It's not the first R-rated Marvel film or action film. There was Blade. There was Watchmen, 300, that kind of stuff. But none of them had, like, a whole bunch of boning in it.
Yeah, and this one is still funny. And so I think people might lose perspective of the R rating. And it is R. And it is a definite oddball superhero flick. It is entertaining, it's funny, it's sarcastic, it's witty, but it is still very, very strange.
Well, it's so self-aware. He goes to the X-Men mansion. We've seen that in like six films now, and only two X-Men are home, and he says, oh, that's no coincidence, we can only afford two of you, and you're backbenchers anyway. Colossus shows up, and Negasonic Teenage Warhead.
It looks suspiciously like, what's her name, who sings Nothing Compares to You.
Sinead O'Connor.
So there are a few jokes about that in the movie as well. But yeah, and what makes this movie similar in some respects to the traditional X-Men type movie, it is the origin story of this character who was a mercenary turned, what would you call it? He basically he's a special forces guy who turns into a mercenary who really walks a very fine line between good guy and bad guy. And he, just when he's starting to finally get his life back together or together for the first time after hooking up with this former prostitute hot chick who becomes the love of his life, he ends up being diagnosed with terminal cancer. And the whole basis of this movie really is that he allows himself to go through these ridiculously torturous experiments that would rid him of his cancer but give him the ability to self-heal. And but it also scars him terribly, and so he wants to get all of his scars fixed before he goes back to the girlfriend who just assumes he's dead.
They make full use of his ability to self-heal. He repairs broken limbs, gunshot wounds, a broken neck, and regrows an appendage.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring up the supporting characters, because as Deadpool is offbeat, so are the supporting characters. Usually these guys live in the Batcave or in a mansion or, you know, just somewhere normal or to fit their millionaire lifestyle. Deadpool lives in a crack house. with a blind old black woman, she calls herself an ex-cocaine addict, Blind Al, played by Leslie Uggams. And she is hysterical, and she's always putting together IKEA furniture, which they have fun pronouncing. And my other favorite supporting character is the bartender at his dive bar. His name's Weasel. He's played by comedian T.J. Miller, and he does a really good job. He almost gets a comedian's 2 minutes just sitting there. When he first sees Deadpool take off his mask and he sees his face, you know, he riffs so much on the scars. You know, he says, "Your face looks like Freddy Krueger had sex with a topographical map of Utah." How brilliant is an insult like that?
It is. It's filled with a lot of those brilliant little insults. It's for the right audience, it's going to be a real gem. Again, it's not for everyone. If you're not into superhero movies at all, this probably is not the first one you want to see because you're not going to get it. But if you have a familiarity with enough of these characters and a certain cynical and sarcastic sensibility, and maybe are a Ryan Reynolds fan, then it's definitely worth checking out.
There's no way Deadpool will be someone's first superhero film. These are not new.
I hope not.
I wasn't the biggest fan of the villain, Ed Skrein.
Yeah, I didn't like the villain.
You might remember
him.
He was from the Transporter Refueled, which didn't refuel anything. It killed that franchise. And he plays a man named Ajax, and he's not a very nice guy. His superpower is he can't feel anything, pain or emotion. So he's got the empathy of a serial killer.
And it was actually kind of difficult to figure out if he was supposed to be a completely bad guy or if there were decent motives behind the original attempts to actually experiment on this guy and cure him of his cancer. So it's not a clear-cut good versus evil movie at all.
To wrap it up, Hannah, I loved Deadpool. I think the later comic book films coming out this year are in trouble if people really take Deadpool to heart. They are not going to take this stuff seriously anymore.
I think they still will. I still look forward to the next Captain America. I would love to see this Deadpool character face off against Iron Man. I think this is like Iron Man to the extreme is how I would characterize Deadpool. And I think this is probably the best of the new movies that are out this week.
Did you see Deadpool, thankfully, is not a sequel. It incorporates information from previous films, previous franchises, but it's not a sequel. It's original. The next film we're going to talk about is a sequel, and it's not a direct sequel. It's from a film a lot of you might not remember or be aware of from 15 years ago. We're talking about Zoolander 2. Now, I did some quick mental math while I was in the theater because I was bored out of my skull during this movie, and I thought, 15 years. All right, I saw the original when it came out in 2001. However, if it had been a sequel, I would not know about its origin because it would be from 1986, and I was not watching movies in 1986. So anybody younger than, well, really, I don't know, 25 is probably not well versed as we are in Zoolander.
I don't know. I think a lot of people got to know Zoolander later as a rental and as a, you know, on TV streamed and on VHS perhaps and then DVD. And so I know that the person who I took as my plus one for this, it was a huge, huge Zoolander fan, and she's about your age, and she knew all the lines, she knew all the characters, and it's important to note that while this movie is being universally panned by critics, there were people in that movie theater who absolutely enjoyed it, who were Zoolander fans, and she is a diehard Zoolander fan. She does not see all that many movies, and for her, this was just a fun, nostalgic escape, and she enjoyed it. I enjoyed the first half hour, I would say, and the last 20 minutes. Everything in the middle, I was bored to tears, but it had a strong beginning and a pretty entertaining end, but unfortunately, it did not hold together throughout.
The original Zoolander tanked at the box office. Some people say it's because it was because of 9/11, came out a couple weeks after that. People weren't ready to laugh yet, or everyone saw the previews like I did and assumed it was awful. It gained cult classic status. It became this huge behemoth on the post-release DVD market, and it's still quoted ad nauseum to this day. Everybody knows Blue Steel. Everybody knows Magnum, and everyone's probably practiced their own Blue Steel. Everyone has their favorite quotes. I love John Voight's little aside, I didn't raise my boy to be a mermaid, and he gets all uppity, merman, merman, and it's brilliant. Everyone still quotes Zoolander. Nobody is going to quote Zoolander 2. Maybe for the next couple days, after they see it and it's fresh in their mind, no jokes from this movie will stick.
I'm not sure I'm ready to bet another airline bottle of wine on this one, but I have a suspicion that Zoolander will take a decent portion of the box office only because I think it will get that initial wave of people who really, 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 really love the first movie and are very curious about the second and have seen the trailer and it looks entertaining to them. And so it's really the only PG-13 option out there that is something that's a little more family friendly. So based on how some movies have been doing recently, like a Kung Fu Panda 3, it's possible that Zoolander will do pretty well simply because it's really the only family-friendly movie out there for the weekend.
It takes place, they have some money behind this, because they actually film it in Rome. And you see the Pantheon, I think in the first screen, there's a hooded figure running for his life because there are some assassins on top of motorcycles gunning for him. And no spoilers here, it doesn't matter because it happens in the first 20 seconds, but Justin Bieber dies and the entire audience applauds. Celebrities are being killed, and it falls to Penelope Cruz, who works for Interpol, to find out why. Why are celebrities being killed? And at the same time, Derek Zoolander and Hansel return, and they try to regain their status as mega superstar models for their various reasons. And what it could have been the best part of this movie, mocking contemporary fashion, how has fashion changed in the last 15 years? They almost address it, but they don't, and they move forward and they leave it in the dust. What I mean by almost address it is the biggest designer in the world right now is Don Ataris, played by Saturday Night Live's Kyle Mooney, and he thinks if it sucks, it's awesome. So listening to him talk is really hard because he's like, oh, that's awful. I love it. You guys are so old and lame, but you're amazing. And so if it sucks, he loves it. And he holds his fashion show on top of a medical waste dump because no one really cares about fashion anymore, according to this film. And the biggest supermodel right now is All. All is played by Benedict Cumberbatch, and you don't know if it's a he or she. It's very androgynous. He/she answers all questions with "I am all." So Derek Zoolander has no idea what to make of all, but that's what this movie is saying: where fashion has come. You can't. They're actually poking at progressivism, I think, because they say mono marriage has just been legalized. All married himself, herself, and they were so close to getting to having relevant comedy, but they missed.
They come close in a lot of places with some of their cameos. There's cameos galore in this one. Kiefer Sutherland plays himself as a member of Hansel's orgy family, which is, you know, just think about that. He has an orgy family of very bizarre characters. And
I think there's a goat involved.
Yeah, it's kind of gross. And Kiefer Sutherland, though, totally pokes fun at himself in this movie, which is nice. And Neil deGrasse Tyson has a very funny little cameo in there. So it's a very wide range of people that just pop up in this movie. And come to think of it, the best part of the movie, I think, is Will Ferrell. I think when he's on the screen as the villain, things brighten up a bit, and he seems he's so in on the joke, and he's in on how ridiculous Zoolander is, and that plays very well, I think, in the final part of the movie. Again, the whole hour in the middle is really atrocious, but there were some flashes of what could have been a very, very, very good scene or two, and they just lost their way a little bit.
I thought Will Ferrell was one of the worst parts of the film. he screams. It's what he does. It's his character, but he screams every line. Every line he screams, and it's annoying. I remember that from the first film. Okay, I've seen it. I saw that for 2 hours, and now I'm tired of it. However, they ignored their story. It fell off the tracks because they ignored the story to focus on cameos. There might be well over 100 cameos. There are so many superstars, famous people who just show up for no reason. that it's not necessarily distracting, it's just tedious, and it makes it choppy. The editing becomes choppy. So they're in the scene, the main characters are acting, and all of a sudden they'll jump cut to a celebrity who obviously just showed up for 10 seconds. They say one thing, and they go back to the scene. So you can tell the person was never really in the room. They probably shot it somewhere else. And it doesn't work. And it's so many. I don't want to start naming them all, because if you name a famous person right now, they're probably in Zoolander 2.
I heard that Laura Bush declined an offer to do a cameo in this as a member of the Orgy family. And so props to Laura for actually recognizing that that might not have been the best move.
Shame on her. That probably would have made the movie awesome.
Perhaps.
To wrap it up, Zoolander 2 stinks.
It's pretty bad, but I do think that huge fans of the original who really want to see it should, and everyone else can wait and see it as a rental or skip it altogether.
All right, break, new film. But first, have you ever seen an episode of How I Met Your Mother?
I think I've seen one or two.
Well, I saw every single episode of that show, which was probably on for like 7 to 9 seasons or something. It went forever, and it was on CBS, and it just ended like 2 years ago. Started in 2007. And With Doogie Howser as Barney Stinson. And all I could think of while we were watching How to Be Single, this Valentine's Day Hollywood scam to get single women into the theater, was they stole. There is direct theft from How I Met Your Mother. Three of the main characters in How I Met Your Mother go to Wesleyan. Alice and Josh from How to Be Single go to Wesleyan. Lily and Marshall from How I Met Your Mother. Lily breaks up with Marshall. She wants to take a break. She wants to find out who she is as a person. Who am I when I'm not in a relationship? What can I become? In How to Be Single, Alice breaks up with Josh. Josh, I don't know who I am. We've been going out for 4 years. I need to find out who I am. And all that means is I want to have meaningless sex with a bartender. She realizes her mistake, and Josh, good on you, buddy. He says, you know what? I didn't need to experiment to know that I loved you, so take a hike. So she sets herself up in the big, scary city of New York City, becomes best friends with Rebel Wilson, who's going to teach her the ins and outs of being single.
Yeah, I mean, Rebel Wilson is funny. She plays the exact same character that I think she plays in Pitch Perfect and pretty much every other thing that she's been in the past couple of years. The problem with that is that I think a lot of younger girls are going to want to go see this movie because they see the trailer, they see Rebel Wilson, they think comedy. This is R-rated, and the R is not for romance at all.
Nice line.
Thank you. It's just raunchy in some parts. It's just about, I don't know what the message was, the takeaway that they really expect single, married, or otherwise engaged women to take away from this movie. I did not leave feeling anything for any of these characters at all. And it was disappointing. I think a lot of young women are going to go see it this weekend. I think it will be one of those ones where you have a couple of Cosmos, you get your gal pals together, and you go see this movie. And it's a little sort of Sex in the City kind of attraction to it, I guess. But even the one character who plays the sister, the older sister.
Leslie Mann
plays the responsible sister, at least that's how it starts. And she's a obstetrician who suddenly decides that she does indeed want to have a baby after rejecting that notion for a long time, but she doesn't want to have a relationship. So she gets artificially inseminated. And of course, what always happens in a movie like this is as soon as she gets artificially inseminated, she meets some guy. And this poor doofus who doesn't know that she's pregnant falls for her. And it's really just, it reminded me a lot of the Backup Plan movie with Jennifer Lopez and Alex Loughlin, who's now on Hawaii Five-0. And that movie's better. So if you want to see that type of movie, go rent the Backup Plan. It's a more entertaining movie. This one is a mishmash of themes, of characters, and it does not hold together very well at all and does not, in the end, really have a very good message for girls.
The reason you didn't take anything away from How to Be Single is because it contradicts itself. It lies to you. It proclaims saying we're going to show you what single life is today. It's partying, having fun, and dating. That's all it is. However, everyone in the film, is doing what every other rom-com in history has ever done. They're biting their nails, waiting for that special moment when they meet the one. They're all lying to you in this movie. They're waiting to meet the one. They just want to go dancing while they're waiting. And you brought up the Leslie Mann character. She is an obstetrician, and she's got to be in her late 30s, I assume.
I don't know. I would put her mid-30s, maybe.
And she's so convinced, I want to be career first. She makes fun of a person in labor while she's delivering her baby. No, I never want a child, but you're doing so good. You're going to be great at it. And she spends 30 seconds with a kid, like a six-month-old, and then she says, okay, I want a kid now. That's so contrived. And so I had to look at the writers, Abby Cohn and Mark Silverstein. They adapted this from a novel, a 2008 novel, which is perfect timing because I think it stole everything from 2007's season one of How I Met Your Mother. And they adapted The Vow and He's Just Not That Into You.
So they've got a formula going, only those were actually probably better than this one. So
He's Just Not That Into You is better than this.
Yeah, and I think The Vow is a little better than this. But again, it's really just, it doesn't go anywhere good. In the end, it's just kind of a bummer. It's not the kind of Valentine's Day gal pal movie that I would have expected. It's not a Bridesmaids caliber.
No, it's not movie. So How to Be Single. It's saying the person who's being the best at single, the person who's doing it right, is Rebel Wilson. She goes to clubs, she stays up all night, she's late to work, but she's having fun. So she's doing it right. And if you feel bad about yourself sometimes that you're not doing it right, well, you're not jumping up and down like Rebel Wilson. That's how it's done. The person who's doing it wrong is Lucy, played by Alison Brie. She wants to get married, and she knows exactly when she's going to get married, and it's 18 months to the day when she meets the one. And she developed her own dating website algorithm. She has spotty Wi-Fi, so she spends all day at the bar downstairs. And, of course, the bartender is a one-night stand chauvinist. He's a playboy. He's Barney Stinson. And so, of course, what happens? Tom, the bartender, falls in love with Lucy, the long-term relationship looker. Oh, no, what are they going to do?
Yeah, again, they tried to go in too many different directions. There wasn't full character development of anyone, and so in the end, you didn't care about anyone or their ultimate happiness.
I did not like the lead actress, Alice, played by Dakota Johnson, who everybody knows now from 50 Shades of Grey. In fact, this could be a loose 50 Shades of Grey prequel. I could see Anastasia Steele breaking up with her long-term steady boyfriend, having a couple one-night stands, and then boom, walking into Christian Grey's office.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, the moment she appeared on screen, she looked an awful lot like her character Anastasia Steele did in 50 Shades. And so it became actually a little more difficult to separate that because I kept thinking about her character in that movie and they were just a little too similar.
Just the worst, the writing's bad all around, but the worst egregious example is she meets a guy at an alumni event. She's putting herself out there trying to find guys. So this guy, he's a millionaire, real estate developer, takes her to Rockefeller Center, see the tree, and they start making out. Boom. Jump cut. 3 months later, they automatically get in a big fight because she's trying to play mommy to his, I don't know, 2-year-old. And there was no setup. There's no backstory. That's just what happened. There was nothing in between. They had these scenes just like, oh, they're kissing. Oh, my gosh, they had a big fight. That is so choppy.
Yeah, it was. It was very choppy. The acting wasn't so bad. A lot of these movies, you know, sometimes you just think, my God, it's not just poorly written, but poorly acted. I think these people actually did the best they could do with the script. I just think that the script was fundamentally flawed to begin with.
Rebel Wilson did well. I was happy when I saw her. She's the funniest. She has the best lines. Problem is, we don't see her a lot. But, oh, man, I hated this movie. I hate this movie worse than Zoolander 2.
If I had to make a choice between The Choice, which was the romantic drama that came out a week or two ago, and this movie for Valentine's Day, I would actually go with The Choice.
This hurts. I did not like The Choice, and I'm telling you, go see The Choice over How to Be Single.
It's not a difficult choice to make with this one.
Oh, man, it's so bad.
Yeah, it's just It's just weak.
All right, well, if you're more discerning in what you see at the multiplex, and you're not into the latest superhero movie, Deadpool, and you're not into the latest crazy comedy sequel, Zoolander 2, and you're not going to set foot into How to Be Single because, you know, maybe you're just a dude, there's a new documentary out, or some people call it infotainment, and it's by Michael Moore. Now, everyone already has their predispositions when you hear the name Michael Moore. It's an extreme name. You love him, you hate him. There's no really middle of the road. But this time, he does something the same and a little bit different. The same is, he's still the main character of his documentary. Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11, Sicko. It's Michael Moore, front and center. So this time, he goes to Europe. And he visits about half dozen countries. And it's a gimmick. The shtick is, I'm going to take this American flag, and I'm going to invade your country and steal your good ideas. Now, this is where it works, in my opinion. Once you get past the gimmick, once he starts talking about substance, it works. For example, he goes to Italy. And the best line is, he looks around, why is it that everyone in Italy walks around like they just had sex? It's brilliant because he says they get proper vacations. They get like 6 weeks of paid vacation a year, and he studies about how that affects the workplace and how that affects the workforce. He goes to France and he studies their school lunches, and he compares their system to our system, and he shows kids over there what our kids eat, and they screamed. He talks about the education system from Finland, the prison system from Norway, the drug rehabilitation in Portugal, and then he goes to Tunisia where it falls off the rails, and that part didn't work for me. But overall, I was impressed with where to invade next, minus the gimmick.
This was one of my least favorite Michael Moore documentaries. I usually am behind him. I like his ideas in principle. I appreciate where he was trying to go with this, but unlike Sicko that focused on the healthcare system, Fahrenheit 9/11 that focused on how we got over, you know, what happened in the aftermath of 9/11 and the misinformation that had been out there, and Bowling for Columbine about gun violence, Roger and Me. I mean, these were movies that had a definite focus. This movie, to me, by not having a focus, it's too long for a documentary, hitting the 2-hour mark. And you could tell as the movie progressed, it started out very engaging with Italy and with that whole story. But I think it was getting long, and they just started short shrifting all these other segments within this movie, and it lost its way. And it lost its ability to really, truly point out why some of these things were really important, why the system worked better in these countries. And a lot of them would not work here. And so I found myself talking back to the screen being like, yeah, you can't have that prison system here where these murderers get to hang out in these really nice prisons with, you know, for a maximum of 10 years and everyone's okay with that. It lost the idea that these people are then really in intense rehabilitation programs in addition to their incarceration, and you would never be able to do that here. The victims' rights lobby and families of murder victims would not tolerate somebody being given a maximum 10-year sentence. And here Michael Moore finds this one guy who is okay with this murderer who had killed his son in a mass murder getting out after a certain number of years and being in this rather cushy prison environment. And so I just felt that you could go anywhere in the world and anywhere even in the U.S. and find these slivers of programs and people that will promote your viewpoint. And the longer the movie went on and the more things he tried to tackle, the less engaged I was.
I think Where to Invade Next will be more accessible to people than, say, Fahrenheit 9/11 or Sicko was. Which were polarizing. I loved Bowling for Columbine. I thought it was an outstanding documentary, but, you know, if you are Second Amendment militia kind of person, you're not going to like it. However, the reason why this is going to work for more people is because he's not America bashing. He's not saying America's horrible because we don't do this. He's saying, look at other ideas, look at these programs, look what other people are doing. Maybe we should just look at it. Consider it, roll it around, because a lot of this stuff people say, oh, it's non-starters, we couldn't even discuss it. Why can't you even discuss it? Why can't you even talk about it?
I think this movie's going to fail for the same reason that TV Nation, which was in some ways a very brilliant TV show that he did, that did individual segments that went to find really clever ideas. It didn't work ultimately because people lost interest. And I think this movie, people will lose interest. It tries to do too much. And if you're not a Michael Moore fan, this movie is not going to... You're just not going to go see this as your first Michael Moore documentary. And so I think the people that really appreciate a Fahrenheit 9/11 or a Sicko or, any of his movies that do take a very specific viewpoint, I don't think they're going to like this treatment.
I don't know why this couldn't be someone's first Michael Moore documentary. It's one of the most accessible.
I think it could, but I don't think they will go. I think people already know they either like Michael Moore or they don't. And it's only going to attract people who already like Michael Moore documentaries, and I think a lot of them are going to be disappointed.
Well, I put Where to Invade Next in my top five documentaries of the year. I really got a lot out of this film. I loved it. I heard your description of it, though, but I didn't really get your opinion. What do you think?
It would not have been in my top five documentaries at all. I was disappointed. And so I think that ultimately it was a missed opportunity and he tried to do too much. And in the end, he diluted the message entirely.
All right. And for those folks who are even more pure, thinking, oh, Michael Moore documentary, that's so accessible. It's so mainstream. I have something for you.
Woo. Can't wait.
In very limited runs, only in major cities of America and only in 1 week spurts.
In other words, something no one will see.
I saw it.
In other words, something no one will see.
Orson Welles' 1965 Chimes at Midnight. This film was lost for decades. You just couldn't see it because it just a lot of rights disputes about it. But finally, we have a new re-release. It is cleaned up. It's polished. It looks like not necessarily a 2016 film, but it doesn't look like a 1965 film either. It does sound like a 1965 film. It is low-quality dubbing. The people speaking aren't actually speaking. That's a little bit off-putting. However, Orson Welles' last major narrative work, his last major film, and it was his passion project, he combined five separate Shakespeare plays into a film all around the character of Sir John Falstaff, a man as fat as his ego is big. This is a loud, rambunctious man who really spends all day in the tavern having a good time. And one of his pals, his best pal, is Prince Hal, whose father is Henry IV. Therefore, you know, Prince Hal grows up, becomes Henry V. There's a big battle scene in it, a very famous battle scene, the Battle of Shrewsbury. There's a lot of contrasting involved in Chimes at Midnight. There's the drunken tavern. Everyone's having a good time. Then there's Henry IV, played by John Gielgud in his throne room. Very palatial, very spacious. The tavern's very close in. It's Falstaff and Hal hanging out with hookers and thieves. It's just having a good time. And, however, Falstaff's a tragic figure. Hal becomes king. Does Falstaff still get to hang around? Well, I did say tragic figure. So, take it for what you will. If you like long-lost movies, old movies, you saw all of Orson Welles' films except this one just because you couldn't, now is the time. And if you have bad weather this weekend like we do and you don't want to fight the crowds for Deadpool and Zoolander 2 because it's not your thing and you want to see an adaptation of Shakespeare you've never seen before, this might be right in your wheelhouse.
It sounds like a movie that is made for the cinemaphile and very few others.
I understand where you're coming from. Not going to fight you on that. It's true. This is for cinephiles, but even more, I think it's for Shakespeare files. Even if you're not a big movie fan, I think you would get a lot out of this adaptation. It's combining plays into one, which is usually not done.
And you're taking two things that I really do not like. I'm not a play person, so unless they burst out into song and it turns into a musical, I'm probably not going to be into it. And if it's an old movie that I've never heard of before and it's got Shakespeare themes attached to it, I'm probably not going to go seek it out.
Well, there is the difference, folks. Shakespeare, highbrow, black and white, long lost, in the theaters now for 1 week, or I don't like Shakespeare.
Shakespeare in Love was okay.
Were there any, so for consolation prize, Hannah, was there anything out on DVD this week that piqued your interest?
Nothing that absolutely piqued my interest. Crimson Peak I've never seen, so that did not pique my interest.
Oh,
Sorry. That, I had to throw something in there. Spectre is out. You know, if I think Mission Impossible Rogue Nation is the better version of that genre. So I think if you're looking for a DVD and you haven't seen that one yet, I would vote for that over Spectre. Spectre's fine if you are into seeing all of the Bond movies, but otherwise it's not even close to being one of the best Bonds.
If it came down between Spectre and Crimson Peak, I'd say Spectre. Even though I expected to like Crimson Peak more, it's Guillermo del Toro. It's a gothic romance taking place in this mansion in the north of England, and it's got this Pride and Prejudice vibe almost, but it's a horror film as well. And it's really not a very good story. Spectre was good. It wasn't great. It wasn't Skyfall. It wasn't Casino Royale. It was Spectre.
Yeah.
It had a great opening and a bunch of blah.
And your favorite song, Sam Smith, Writing
yes,
on the Wall.
It's it's the best song you've never heard, folks. The more intriguing film out this week is Grandma.
Right.
A kind of a gift to Lily Tomlin. So if you're a Lily Tomlin fan and you haven't seen Grandma, shame on you.
Yeah, I mean, she was nominated for, what was she nominated for? Something like a Golden Globe? And I was really shocked. Whatever she was nominated for, I'm like, no, this is not a nomination-worthy role. It's one of those labor of love projects, and she's got her dry wit going, and it's interesting, but it's just one of those nice, simple indies that if you do like Lily Tomlin and you like just a quiet indie movie, then it's worth seeing. There are some funny moments to it. It has some very poignant material in there, too. But
it's a day in the life about abortion.
Yeah.
She's trying to get an abortion for her granddaughter, who's still in high school, I think. And so it's not nice, but
it's
funny.
It has funny moments. It has poignant moments. It's
it has Sam Elliott.
Sam Elliott is actually probably to me the best part of this movie. I thought his supporting role as a former lover of the grandma Lily Tomlin character was probably the most unexpected and well-written part of that movie.
He probably was the best part of that film. He was very good. I think he was in my top 5 supporting actors. He was that good.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So, wrap up. I say get to the theater to see Deadpool. You've never seen anything like this before, but leave your 13-year-old at home. They're going to beg you to see it and just rise above it. Don't do it. Hannah?
And if they insist on seeing something, just send them to see Zoolander 2 while you go see Deadpool.
Yeah, that'll show them.
And then just don't let your teenage girls see How to Be Single, please.
No, I forgot. How to Be Single is filthy. I mean, it's funny filthy, but man, that's filthy.
It's not for the under 17 crowd at all.
The documentaries in the theaters have been sparse in the past week, so if you're kind of been fiending for one, you can do very well by Michael Moore's Where to Invade Next. You can bring up these ideas at work, and then when people say where they're from and you say Michael Moore and they shout you down, well, there you go.
Michael Moore movies are definitely good for opening dialogue. I will give him that.
There's the check your local listings for Orson Welles' Chimes at Midnight.
Look very, very carefully in the fine print.
I would expect to see a Criterion release in the future, if it's not already on, I bet. We talked about the 3 DVD releases. I think we're falling on the side of go rent Grandma.
Yeah. It's, well, I don't know. It's still a limited amount of people that I think would like Grandma. But it's probably the best of those 3.
Do you want to wager another bottle of airplane wine?
First of all, it's not airplane wine. It is slightly larger than your little airplane bottle.
It's pretty small.
It's small, but it was $4.99 plus tax. So it did put me over the $5 minimum.
Yeah. What a trooper. You're so altruistic.
I am not one to welch on a bet. And so I'm torn. I do think it's worth... If I had to wager, I would say that Zoolander and Deadpool and The Choice will divide the box office pretty closely. Or not The Choice. I'm sorry. How to Be Single. Because of the Valentine's Day weekend, I think you might find that the 3 come in pretty close. I will give Deadpool the edge, but I think Zoolander is going to be very close to
Deadpool.
All right.
Since I want to bet, I'm going to make it interesting. I'm picking Deadpool. Uh-huh. And I say Deadpool will make more money than Zoolander 2 and How to Be Single combined.
Okay, I will take that bet.
You're on. And I think if I win, and I'm going out on a limb here, I think the loser owes a full bottle of wine.
Okay, so you didn't specify that last time.
Oh, I'm taking a risk, but I'm still confident.
You mean
confident.
Like with a cork?
Zoolander 2 plus How to Be Single combined will not equal the take of Deadpool.
Okay, I will take that bet.
Outstanding. I know next week is kind of a calmer week. I know the new movie Race is coming out about Jesse Owens and the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And that's pretty much, I think, the only wide release next week.
Yeah, it's going to be slim pickings.
We're going to have to talk about that for a while.
I know. We'll find something else to talk about. Maybe we could drag one out of the dustbin from...
Actually, we could probably do Oscars if we pick the winners.
Oh, that's right. That will be our last opportunity to really give our predictions. So there you go.
All right.
Oscar predictions next week.
Stay tuned next week for
Race.
That's going
to be a lot of bottles of wine on the line for that one.
I'm not saying who should win, or maybe it's going to be who will win. Maybe it'll be if we pick the winners is if who should win. It's my opinion, on who should win.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not on who I think will win.
No, it's going to be a little bit of a debate, I'm sure, on our emotional choices versus our... what our head says versus what our heart says about who might take home the Oscar.
Well, as always, everybody, thank you very much for listening to The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell. This is Hannah Buchdahl.
Happy Valentine's Day. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.